Tracy Pickett, you're very welcome to Kerry for a start. Of course, you're well used to coming to Kerry.
I am. I love coming down here. It's a pity it's such a long drive, but it's well worth it. And yeah, it's great to be back.
The last time I spoke to you was on my own radio programme, Terrace Talk, and you announced to one and sundry that you were pregnant.
I certainly did. It seems like only yesterday, but yeah, she's 20 months old now, and it's been fantastic.
Our lady listeners out there will be very interested in this because her name is Tia, if I pronounce it right, and it's a beautiful name, but a very unusual name.
Yeah, it is. It was a name that I heard on a film that I was watching called Blood Diamond, and it was the name of a little boy, actually, in Sierra Leone, which was one of the main characters of the film. And because at the time I was expecting, and I didn't know whether she was going to be a girl or a boy, but I thought it was a lovely name, and I slightly changed the spelling to T-H-E-A, and just by coincidence, it transpired that in Greek mythology, the goddess Tia was the goddess of the sun and the dawn, which I thought was lovely because she is, you know, she's got such a lovely, bright, sunny face. And then my father tells me that in Greek mythology also, the goddess Tia was married to the god Hyperion, purely, again, by coincidence, and Hyperion, as I'm sure a lot of racing people would know, was the very first foundation stallion of all thoroughbreds. So really, every racing thoroughbred pedigree that you look at now all would always go back to the foundation stallion, who was Hyperion. So it was a very nice and unusual coincidence and connection to horse racing.
There had to be horse racing in that, and there will be in that young lady. You're a very busy lady yourself. You have a very busy life, and you do tremendous work, which we'll be talking about, for charity all over the world. How can you combine? Do you find it difficult now combining motherhood with your work?
Well, no, I don't really. I'm very lucky because I have a great support system around me. I mean, I don't have family living in Ireland, but I feel I have family because I have so many good friends who do help me with Tia. So I'm able to still carry on working. Obviously, my work with RTE, which takes me to quite a lot of places around the country. But also, I think now, as you know yourself, with computers and the internet, it's much easier to work from home. And so we have an office just connected to beside the house. So I'm able to do a lot of my work from home. I have a wonderful girl called Jenny who helps with Tia some days during the week. So, no, it isn't too difficult. And I'm one of these people. I love challenges and I love variety, and I get plenty of that.
Your dad is one of the most famous sports people in the world. He's a legendary figure. What has it been like, Tracy, growing up being the daughter of Lester Pickett, and has it opened doors for you, and has it helped you in life? Or it must be something very special.
Well, yes, I have obviously been asked that question before, and I suppose the first thing that springs to mind is that I've never known any other life or what it would be like not to have had a famous father. I suppose in some cases when somebody's parent, mother or father, becomes famous when they're 10, 12 or 15, then their life changes. Whereas I was born in 1965 when my father was kind of reaching his first sort of peak of success. So I haven't really known any other type of life. But I suppose if I look back, it obviously was quite different when I compare it to other friends growing up. I mean, he wasn't there very often. He was always very busy travelling. And when he was at home, if he wasn't studying the form or, you know, he would be in the sauna and what we call wasting, trying to watch his weight, which obviously, you know, isn't a very nice thing. So he wouldn't be the sort of father who'd be jumping around happy all the time. He was always very, very focused and very, very disciplined. And I suppose in turn then that taught me that if you want to get anywhere or do anything properly, you really have to have this tunnel vision and be very, very focused. So there were some advantages in that way that I learnt a lot from watching him. And, you know, I had great pride in having him as a father. I suppose it was strange because people say, oh, you know, is your father Lester Pickett? And people would react differently to you. So I think I learnt, you know, some people are your friends genuinely and some possibly not, maybe because of who you are. So that was an advantage too. I don't think I'd have changed it. I think it has been very interesting living, you know, as the daughter of a famous person. As about opening doors, yes, I think definitely it had that advantage as regards possibly my first job in RTE, 20 years ago, my goodness, this year. But what I always said, and as I was rightly told by my boss at the time, yes, it might open a door, but it would close very, very quickly if you weren't capable of doing the job. And sometimes when you are the offspring of a famous person, there is more pressure on you to prove yourself. So, you know, I think that I managed to do that. And I'm always learning. I think life is a great journey. You know, it has its ups and it has a lot of downs as well. But I think the day that one stops actually looking around and learning from your mistakes and learning from the things that happen to you, then, you know, I think that's a sad day. So it's a continual learning process.
What would your dad consider to have been his most famous event, his most famous win, or his most remembering time in his life? Talking to you personally now, what does he remember best, Tracy?
I don't really know. He's quite a private, he's a very private man and a quiet person, quite an introspective person. I know that when he was asked which was his favourite horse, he named about five of them. But I know Sir Ivor always stood out for him. He was a great horse, obviously. He was trained by Vincent O'Brien all those years ago. But I know that my father would always talk about Sir Ivor. He was a super horse. And Nijinsky was the other one, obviously. And I think Nijinsky stood out for my father because he was such an individual. He was very unique. He was very headstrong, which possibly was his undoing towards the end of his career. But he had exceptional speed and great personality. I know that for my father coming back that time after he'd been in prison and all the things that went with that, I think everything that led up to him riding Royal Academy in the Belmont Stakes was very important to him. And after Vincent O'Brien's funeral a few weeks ago, I was speaking to him as we were driving to the afters in the K Club. And, you know, he said, if it wasn't for Vincent, I probably would never have taken my license out again. And he was telling me about how Vincent had rung him and asked him to pop over to Dublin, and they met in a hotel in Dublin, and Vincent put it to him, why don't you take your riding licence out again? And my father really hadn't thought that ever being a possibility. But after talking to him for some time, and Vincent said, you know, I'll get you back and I'll give you a few rides and to get you right, and you never know what'll happen after that. And so he did, and he rode four horses for Vincent at the Curragh on a very wet Tuesday in October. And all four of them won. There shouldn't have been anybody there, but because they heard that Leicester was riding, it was fantastic. The place was absolutely packed. And as I say, all of them duly came up trumps. And then to get that chance ride on Royal Academy, because his jockey wasn't well at the time and couldn't... That was John, wasn't it? He couldn't ride him. It was just a fairy tale, and the whole combination back together again of Vincent and my father. So I think if you really sat him down and said, come on, what is the most memorable? I'm sure if he looks over all the years of his career, that would have to be a huge highlight, because a lot of people wrote him off and said, he'll never be back to his best again, and all, you know, criticised him. But the way he rode that race and the way he lifted him almost over the winning post, I think really proved all the doubters that, yeah, Leicester was really back. And that was a very proud moment for me, definitely.
The main thing is he's fit and well, Tracy, is he?
Yeah, he is. I mean, we all read about the health problems a couple of years ago. He had a serious heart attack, and that was sorted out. And I must say, he's in great form. Yeah, he looks really, really well. Again, it's another, you know, he's nearly 74, and it's very inspiring to see that somebody, you know, can pick themselves up and get on with it like he does. You know.
You might give him our regards from people in Kerry, because I know that he was honoured at the Killarney races, my own home course, a number of years ago. And tell him the people in Killarney and Finbar Slattery and all the lads were asking for him. You might do that.
I certainly will. Finbar has always been a wonderful friend to the family, and he often writes to my mother and father. And yes, he instigated bringing my father over for that evening meeting. And I was there that night, and it was absolutely fantastic.
Remarkable man, Finbar.
Yeah, he is. He's just exceptional. And as I say, he's been a great friend to the family over the years. And I know how proud he was that night and how excited he was. And the atmosphere at Killarney races that evening in the early 90s, it was just fantastic. And then, of course, the winners that came with it. So I know Daddy had a lovely time, because he rode in the jaunty... Is it the jaunty car?
The jaunty cars.
Yes, that's it.
And strange enough, at the moment, the Jarvis are on strike, Tracy.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, you mustn't be reading the papers or watching the RT News, people you work with, because they're on strike because the National Park in Killarney are demanding that the horses wear nappies to collect the dung when they're... This has gone on now, and there's a strike going on, and it's getting very, very serious. So, check that out. That's a coincidence now.
I've been trying not to read the papers because of all the bad news at the moment. But, that's interesting. But you see, the horse dung is very good for the plants, you know. It could be a great fertiliser. So maybe they wouldn't need to wear the nappies. But never, I shouldn't get into that. I could get into trouble. But, he had a great day with Barney Curley out on the jaunty car. So, he loves Kerry.
Well, it is nice to hear anyway, Tracy Pickett, backing up the Jarvis. Anyway, Tracy, come here, your own life. You started over 20 years ago in RT, and you have been involved in all aspects of sport, and you've been involved in presenting programmes and everything. You must be really enjoying that. And it's no bother to you.
Well, I don't know if it's no bother to me, but yes, obviously after 20 years, you don't feel the same pressure probably as you do in the first few years of a career. And I fell into the television quite by accident, and I was very, very lucky. I don't know if it would be that easy these days, because it's such a competitive business now. But, I was very, very lucky. You know, I started doing racing with RT in 1989, and I can't believe it's that long ago. But, you know, that then developed into other parts of sport. I fronted Sport Stadium for a few years. I did Sunday Sport. I did a sports quiz show, and I had that nice little a chat show, which was fun, when they asked different people to front a Saturday night chat show. So I really enjoyed that because I got to interview George Best, which was a great honour.
Actually, I was going to ask you the next question, talk to us about George Best, because I knew you had interviewed him.
Yeah, I mean, he was an absolute gentleman. I think I was very fortunate because on that evening he definitely wasn't drinking, and I decided I wanted to talk to him about more present things and what he thought of players today and how the game had changed since he was playing. And at that time he was working with Sky, and you know, I asked him about his job and his different opinions on soccer today. And rather than going back to the same old territory that he'd been asked before about his drinking and womanizing and all that sort of thing, and afterwards we all retired to the green room for a few drinks afterwards to relax after the programme. And he said, you know, I just want to thank you for giving me one of the most relaxing and enjoyable interviews I've had in many, many years. And he said it was because I didn't go back over the same old thing. And he found it refreshing to be asked his opinion of young players now. And that meant a lot to me. I thought that was very, very nice. And he was an absolute gentleman. His partner, Alex, was with him at the time. And I was thrilled, very, very honoured to meet him. And you know, it was very, very sad when he died, and it's a, you know, terrible illness to have.
In my opinion, he was the best soccer player that I have ever seen. He was the best I've ever seen. The world I saw him playing in Old Trafford, he was absolutely outstanding. It was very sad the way it finished up. And, of course, another hero of mine would be Sean Kelly. You cycled with Sean Kelly, cycled all across America with him.
Yeah, I mean, Sean Kelly would be a huge, huge hero of mine and a great, great friend. I met Sean when I started riding with the Blazing Saddles, which are a wonderful organisation. They have sponsored cycles all around the country and parts of the world, and the money all goes to the National Council for the Blind. So they do great work, and I got involved with them, and I cycled all around Ireland. We did a tour of Malaysia. We were in France, Mallorca, and all sorts of places, and Sean does amazing work for them. And obviously, I'd seen about his endeavours as a professional cyclist, and I became quite an addict at cycling. I absolutely loved it. I raced a bit on the bike. And then I heard about this Ultimate Challenge, which was a 2,875-mile cycle from San Diego to South Carolina across the states. And I said, wow, I'd love to be able to do that. And Sean was leading the group. Eventually, anyway, 28 of us set off. After a good year, about a year and 2 months, I trained for that. And it was a tough program, and he laid it out, the program, for all of us all around the country who were going to go on this huge trip. And we were told we had to stick to it, and I can understand why, because unless you were at this peak of fitness, you were wasting your time. And we averaged 130 miles a day in distance over a 25-day period. We had no day off. And we experienced everything from -7 degrees to hurricane winds to 29 degrees. It was just unbelievable. But Very hard, the hardest thing I've ever done. I'd swim across Galway Bay underwater 20 times before I'd do that again over the cycle. It was very demanding, psychologically, hugely demanding. But he was amazing because, you know, everybody had particular bad days and not always the same. You know, one would be having a bad day when someone else was having a good day. But he would finish each day and then he'd make sure the first lot of us got back to the hotel or whoever was in front, and then he'd get back on his bike, whether he was soaked through the skin with rain and hail or snow, and he'd go back down the road to make sure everyone else was all right and bring them back and encourage them. And you know, he didn't have to do that. He's a wonderful man. I'm listening to him now on the Tour de France doing the commentary for Eurosport, and he's a great example. You know, he's got his cycling team now with On Post, and he's in his 50s and in great shape. He still cycles hundreds of miles every week. And I just think he's a huge inspirational person and a brilliant Irish sportsman.
Would he have been arguably Ireland's greatest ever sportsman, Tracy?
Arguably, yes. He's right up there. He's right up there because he had this amazing versatility as a cyclist. He was able to do the long stage competitions, but he was also able to do the criterium, the one-day events, all through the year. You don't see cyclists doing that anymore, top cyclists. He did them all. And, you know, he held all those green jerseys. Oh, people say, well, he never actually won the Tour. But you sit down and look at his career over the years, and my God, he did more than any other cyclist has ever done. Came from Ireland. Phenomenal.
Do you follow the Gaelic Games? Because I know that before we talk about playing for life, you swam the Channel, did you? Was this, you raised
Galway Bay.
Galway Bay, you raised an enormous amount of money for charity by doing a big long swim.
Yeah, I mean, this was one of the first big challenges that I did. That was in 1998, an age ago now, I suppose. And there was a wonderful man called John Durkin, who was married to a good friend of mine, and he tragically died of leukemia. And I got friendly with his family and his father in particular, Bill Durkin, who owns racehorses and has a building company. And he, obviously, as all the family, were devastated when John lost his battle, because it was a long, arduous battle against an awful disease. And, you know, we all know people who suffered from the likes of that. And he decided to set up a trust fund to raise $5 million over 5 years to build a ward of the St. James's Hospital for research into cancer and leukemia. And I said, well, I'll start the ball rolling with a fundraiser. And I racked my brains anyway what I would do. And I think it was after a couple of glasses of wine anyway, I decided that I would swim across Galway Bay during the races, because I thought that would be a great captive audience. And this was in January time. That was January 98. And then I decided, no, that wasn't, you know, I had to do something more different than that. I'd do it underwater. So, of course, once I'd said this in front of a load of people, I had to stick by it. I'm not one to sort of say I'm going to do something and not do it. So, anyway, to kind
no,
of...
No, you weren't going to hold your breath the whole way across Galway Bay, were you?
A lot of people were hoping that I would, but no. I was very fortunate to be supported by the Garda Underwater Unit. And I had to go to the Garda Commissioner's office in Phoenix Park and ask permission. So I had to explain what I was going to do and could I borrow them for training. And they were absolutely fantastic and said yes. Noel Conroy was the man I spoke to and he was absolutely marvellous. And they trained me and supported me. They'd take me out in a boat across to Lambay Island off Howth and they'd drop me there and I'd have to swim back. This was part of my training. But we learned a system whereby I would almost come to the surface and they were able to change my scuba tanks. There were small little twin tanks within a few seconds so that I wasn't really surfacing. And the idea was to just try and keep going, you know, without any stops. And so I completed that. We did it on the 28th of July. It was a Tuesday evening of the Galway races. And a phenomenal amount of people waited for me because it took 7.5 hours. I thought it would be a lot quicker. And it was very hard going, but we did it. And I couldn't believe, I mean, I remember going to all the cafes and hotels and bars all around Galway, were loaded down with posters and sponsorship sheets and begging people to sponsor me for this swim. And we raised £171,000 for leukemia, which was marvellous. And at the end of, I think after 4 years, I was just one of many people who raised a huge amount of money for the John Durkin Leukemia Trust. And that wing is there now of St James's Hospital doing wonderful research into cancer. So it was a great honour to be part of that.
Yeah, and it was well done because cancer is literally sweeping the country and it has hit all our families in a huge way, and which is, well, I know it myself. Now, so we're talking about sports since we sat down speaking, and that brings us exactly to your charity, Playing for Life, self-development through the education and sport. You're doing tremendous work with that, Tracy, and there's more coming up. But you have come to Kerry, you've brought a few Gaelic footballers out. Talk to us now about your Playing for Life and how you have brought footballers and other sports people into it.
Well, you've been very kind in the past, which you've talked to me about this before, which I really appreciate. And of course, now is harder than ever for any charities to try and raise money. It's difficult at the best of times, but we all know what situations we're in now. So I started it off in 2005, and yes, our first trip out was to Malawi, and we bought 7 GA All-Stars. So Jack O'Shea obviously would be the local man. He came with us, and we had Bomber, of course, would be another great local hero, Bomber Liston, and we had Brian Wheelahan, we had Joe Cooney, we had Henry Shefflin, who was absolutely marvellous. And we had Robbie O'Malley and Barney Rock. So we had a great team of people. And they.
How many All-Ireland medals have all those fellas, Tracy? You could, no, that's a question. Question for my listeners. Tracy's after naming out 5 or 6 there. How many All-Ireland medals have they between them? And there'll be a prize for the first winner. Speak away, Tracy.
Yes, I couldn't answer that question. But they were absolutely marvellous. And we went out and we taught hurling and football, and the kids absolutely loved it, and we brought out all the equipment and whatever, and it was a great week, and we did a programme on it for RTE. But at the end of that week, I realised that yes, this was great fun and whatever, but we could develop it into something a lot more self-sustaining and long-lasting. So up to present day, basically what Playing for Life is about now is that we use sport by way of teaching and educating young kids around the problems with AIDS and HIV and other social issues and health issues that affect people in Africa. And we found that through sport, whether it be soccer or hurling or just physical games in general, that you can actually get these messages across in a fun and challenging way rather than just sitting kids in a classroom and talking at them, which for me, for one, used to hate that as a kid. But what we're finding is that through this program, through sport, the messages about the problems with AIDS are actually hitting home, and then it's encouraging conversation and sharing of experiences between the other kids, and it's been remarkably successful.
What regions are you covering? Are you going to, Tracy?
We go to Malawi, and we go to Kenya, and we go to Tanzania, which is why I'm here tonight, because we work very closely with Father Mike O'Sullivan just outside Arusha, and his brother tonight, Thomas, is launching this fantastic Goshka for Arusha CD of music to help raise money for Mike. And basically what we've now focused on, and again, it started with the trip with the GA All-Stars, and really it's by asking the different communities that we've worked with what they need from us, because they're the only ones that really know, that we've discovered that it's skills training is what people need. So we have the sport side, which is still very predominant and very, very, very effective, that are now being spread out around the schools. We have volunteers, they come out and we ask them to coach kids, anybody with even the most basic love of sport. We have a one-day orientation day, and we explain how the coaching works, and people just have been fantastic coaching the kids. And then the other aspect of what we do is, as I say, the skills training, because once the communities over there have their food situation sorted out, and I'm talking about if they're getting one meal a day, they see that as above the poverty line. Obviously, the next step is, how do you make money for yourself? How can you sustain your family and provide for your relatives and stay within your rural community and not have to drift towards the cities and the slum areas? And what we have found is, through speaking to them, is that if they can gain a skill and get a qualification in a skill, whether it be woodworking, tailoring, block laying, welding, basic IT skills, if they're able to get those, then they're able to set themselves up in a small business enterprise and I'm talking like a little store on the side of the road, or set up with somebody else who's, or, you know, work for somebody else who's already running a small business, then they are able then to provide for themselves and their families. Because a lot of these kids have lost their parents through AIDS. There's very dissected families, and, you know, life is incredibly, incredibly hard. And a lot of them have fell out of the education system, so they don't have that academic background. So for them to be able to gain a skill is giving them the opportunity to look after themselves, be self-sustaining. They don't want handouts. They just want hand up. They want a little leg up to help them go forward. So we provide the training. We put them through a skills training college. They then get the tools of which they would need for their particular skill at the end of that. And so far, in the last, since 2005, we've had a great success rate. And a lot of these young people are now able to make a living. I mean,
so,
nothing like...
So, Tracy, I was going to say, you have seen huge changes, and you are, as the fella said, making a dent in what's happening.
Yes, I mean, a very small dent. And, you know, this I think, was the thing I found difficult when I first got involved in this, is that you're only making tiny, tiny changes. But then I've learned to accept that that's enough. And if everybody just did a small little bit, you know, isn't it lots of little ripples make up a big lake? So... You know, that it is hard when you see the vastness of the problem and the hugeness of the problems over there. But if it wasn't for people like Father Mike, who's based in Arusha in Tanzania, who's able to then carry out the work, you know, to tell us what we need to do, and able to, you know, provide the whole community backbone, then, you know, none of our work would be possible. So we link in with people who are already doing fantastic work there, and we're guided by them. And it really is those people living and working out in those places day in, day out, who are just absolutely fantastic people. And really, they don't get enough praise, I don't think.
Well, we're here in Milltown, as you said, Tracy. Your lunch in Gashka for Arusha, a beautiful CD in aid of the development project out in Tanzania. We're here in Mike Larkin's pub, and Thomas O'Sullivan is doing it all, helping his brother, Father Mike O'Sullivan, who's out there and doing tremendous work, and we'll be appealing to our listeners to support that. But we're appealing for another thing, because you have another fundraiser coming up, and this is very important. And I would like the listeners tonight, on Radio Kerry in particular, to listen carefully what Tracy is organising, and it's a 10K, very simple, and anybody can get involved. And Kerry people are the best people in the world to support fundraisers, Tracy.
Yeah, and I think Irish people in general, they've been fantastic over the years. But again, it's a question of always trying to find new ways to raise money. And it is very difficult for people out there, because times are very, very hard. But what we have a new website, along with the playingforlife.ie. We have runtoafrica.org, which gives you details of some of the runs that have been organised. They're 10K runs around the country. And we're looking for people, if they want to put on a 10K run in their area, just to get in touch with us through that website, runtoafrica.org. And we're asking people then to contribute 20, 25 euros to take part in a 10K run, whether it be in Castle Island or Killarney. There's one that's happening in Lucan. Shawnee Stack has organised one down in County Clare. And we're trying to get these runs up and running, excuse the pun, around the country to help raise money, again, towards the work that we do in Tanzania and Malawi. And then what we are doing in November, we're asking anybody who would be interested in taking part in the Addis Ababa Half Marathon that they can come out with us. Again, one has to fundraise a little bit to cover the cost of their flight and a few nights in Addis Ababa. Again, the details are on our website. You get to run with Haile Gebrselassie, the world champion, legendary runner, as well as other international top athletes. But also, a couple of days before the race itself, you get to sit down, have lunch with Haile Gebrselassie, and he will talk you through the different problems about running at altitude and talk about his career. And I think it's a fantastic opportunity for anyone who is serious about their running and is a great fan of the great Haile, you know, to say, I spent 5 days in Addis Ababa and I sat down with Haile Gebrselassie and ran with him and some of his other athlete friends. So these are things that we're trying to do to keep the fundraising going, but trying not, you know, to expect to people to have to put their hand in their pocket too much, you know, to keep the contribution as low as possible.
Well, we have a great tradition of athletics in Kerry, Tracy. We've had great Olympians, the likes of Tom O'Riordan and all those people, and other people, but I have no doubt there are people listening tonight all over and beyond Kerry, and they're going to fall in and they're going to say, we're going to start something up to help that lady here in Kerry. So I have no doubt there will be a 10K in Kerry, and I'm appealing to all the listeners out there, especially those sports minded men and women, to get on the line straight away, and we'll get cracking straight away and help this lady. Tracy Pickett, was lovely speaking to you, and you're a busy lady. A person wouldn't realise when we'd see you there interviewing those big baiters of rugby men that you're such a busy lady behind it all, and that you're travelling all over the world raising funds and all. So well done, and listen to me, congratulations, and keep up the great work, and thanks for talking to Terrace Talk.
And thanks very much for your time, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Now, Mara O'Reilly, we are here launching the CD for Father Mike. You know all about him because you have been out with him. Tell us where you were and tell us what was happening.
Okay, I'm just back from Tanzania, where we spent 2 weeks in Peloti Parish, which is in the Esso region of Arusha, Tanzania. And we have a small group in Mayo. We're all friends of Father Mike for a long, long time.
How did the friendship develop?
My sister and my late sister, the Lord of Mercy, she died 6 years ago. She was a very good friend of Mike's. And they worked together in Ashford Castle in Cong in 1976. So we're friends ever since. And on what would have been her 50th birthday, my mother found the article in the Irish Catholic by Mike looking for help. So that's how we started doing the project. Yeah. So we're running up now for 3 years. And we send groups of volunteers out, and we do soccer camps and education programmes, and we bring money as well.
Tell us what it's like on the ground out there.
Well, it's very harsh. Nothing can prepare you for the poverty, and yet the nature of the people is amazing. They are so optimistic and friendly and warm and welcoming, but the conditions that they live in are appalling. There's no sanitation, there's no electricity, the houses are mud and wattle. They're absolutely, you wouldn't put an animal in this country living in the conditions that the people live in out there. And yet they will turn up for mass spotless. They turn up for my English classes every day. They turned up spotless and optimistic and happy. And, you know, we could learn an awful lot from the people of Arusha. Yeah.
Father Mike Sullivan, the man that you're helping, does he play a huge part? And is there changes developing from the work that he's doing through ye?
Well, absolutely. I mean, Mike is inspirational. And he's only in that parish 3 years. And the changes in that parish in that time. I would describe him as, he's very charismatic, and he's working, his method of working in the parish is, he's building the parish and the community from the centre out. And he's developing the services, and he's not only developing them and handing them to the people, he's teaching them how to take responsibility themselves and how to have ownership of their parish and of their community. And the work that has gone in already. Now, I'm well aware that he's getting huge help from here, from Milltown and from Playing for Life and from ourselves. We're called Return to Tanzania. And there's another group, Friends of Arusha. But without Mike, he's the linchpin of the whole effort, and he's the guiding hand behind it all.
What would you say to people listening to you this evening now on my programme in relation to why should they help him?
What I would say to people is that, you know, we can't heal the world, but we can heal a little bit. And the little bit that we do here goes so far out there. And I went out there for 2 weeks, and I have come home from it energised and rejuvenated. And, you know, I can't wait to go back, and I want to do more because it's so worthwhile.
So you tell me you teach English.
I do.
Are you an English teacher?
I am.
And can you speak their language? And what is their language?
Well, their language is Swahili, and I don't speak it. I've learned a few words and a few phrases to get by, but it's very important for them to learn English. So I took an English class every day while I was there. Our main group actually went out there teaching soccer, but we have an interesting group. We teach soccer, music, English, computers, and fly tying. And you might wonder why we have fly tying. Well, my husband is a fly tying instructor and a very keen angler. And he started the project last year. because fly tying is it can develop into a very good industry for a place like Arusha. Most flies sold in Ireland for fishing are actually tied in Kenya. So now there are a group of girls tying flies in Father Michael's parish. They send them home to Ireland to my husband. He passes them on to a shop and they are paid directly. So there's no middleman. There's no nobody creaming off the profit or anything. And Mike sent me a text a couple of days ago to say the girls got their first wages and they're thrilled. So that's progress, you know. And there's 5 girls working. That's 5 families now with an income.
Yeah.
And if we build on that, it can go somewhere. So that's why people should help, because even if it's only, like if you only give 10 euro here, that is worth a lot of money out there.
And Father Mike's brother, Thomas, has launched a wonderful CD, hasn't he? So, of course, we hope that people would buy it and support the cause.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, anything that people can do to support the cause, and it's lovely to have something like this CD, and the CD is fabulous. And I've heard it and I've seen it and the work that's gone into it is amazing. And we actually had Thomas up in Galway. We had a big concert in the Town Hall Theatre in Galway in May. And Thomas and Brendan came up and they brought the house down. They could have played all night. They were so fabulous. So I hope everybody buys the CD.
Lovely.
Because it really is a very good cause.
Come here. You're doing great work. It is a credit show. And keep up the good work. Thanks very much for talking to me.
Thanks very much.
My focus this week is on hurling, specifically the Munster hurling finals in Thurles. I came away from Thurles yesterday convinced that neither Waterford nor Tipperary will pose any threat to Kilkenny. I'll be looking to the Cork-Galway game to see if anyone can take on Kilkenny. It's a wonderful day, of course, in Thurles, the home of the GAA, and my fascination always with Thurles is the pitch. Now, traditionally it's regarded as the best pitch in Ireland, and no better man than someone like Cormac Bonner. That'd be Cormac of the famous Bonner family from Tipperary, who is domiciled in Killarney now and is principal of the Presentation School in Milltown. Along with brother Connor and Cullum, he is a star and has been a star with Tipperary in the past. They're all All-Ireland winners and All-Star winners. I asked him specifically about the pitch, and what he said was he feels it's the best hurling surface in Ireland. Many would say it's better than Croke Park, because one of the problems in Croke Park, it gets very hard. That never happens in Thurles. The grass is much shorter. The caretaker, Philly Butler, told us that they actually cut the grass 3 times last week, and you need that kind of low cut to get a true ball in hurling. Cormac told me that when the grass is shorter, the ball will travel quicker, and it's a true ball. It won't deceive you. It's ideal, of course, for anyone from the golf knows all about that, the different surfaces for putting in golf. Talking about that, we'll be tuned into the British Open this week. And apart from the professionals, we'll be looking very much to see how Waterford man David Higgins is doing. Cormac said that there are no excuses. If you can't play hurling in Thurles, you can't play it at all. It's the ideal pitch. Marvellous work has been done on the pitch and indeed on the whole stadium itself, brand new stand, etc. It's the height of summer course, and traditionally they say in Tipperary, when you have Cork bet and the hay saved, it's the ideal summer. Well, Cork are still there and most of the hay saved are right. But for me, anyway, as I looked down on this magnificent stadium, I was thinking very much of founders of the GAA, people like Davin Cusick, the Clare teacher, who was more interested in athletics than in hurling. And we must always remember that the early people like Cusick and Davin really geared the Association for Athletics. Hurling was in second place. After the game, I went to his hotel, of course, where it all started. And it was wonderful to see all the photographs, not just alone of the GAA, but also of soccer, rugby and athletics. The lovely ceremony yesterday called The Torches Passed, in which the 125 years of the GAA was marked. Good to see Chrissy Welsh from Kerry there carrying the torch as well, and my own hero, of course, Jimmy Dial. I always look at the referee, John Sexton. Last weekend, he should have been down here in Kerry celebrating his 18th wedding anniversary, but he had the honour, of course, of doing the hurling final. The start of the game itself, the Artane Boys Band, we can't call them that anymore. They're now called the Artane School of Music. Very good reason for that name. The boys that never seem to grow up, they're like the swallows that come back every year to my own shed. The teams emerged in the tunnel. It was like Cú Chulainn of old. The roll of the drums of Mihalo here said, and the teams are out. Our own Evian, that's a very special moment, certainly for me anyway, when I think of the real Ireland and get on with the game. John Milan in particular takes my fancy, but Tipperary are stronger, stronger all the way. It was nice to see the past captains there as well, wonderful people who have captained hurling winners of the past, starting with, for the last 3 or 5 years, starting with John Fenton of Cork. I had good company on the way as well, of course, to the game. Pat O'Connor and his young son, Kieran. Pat is a league legal in Killarney. Dan Dwyer led a troop of people, including John Wickham. But most of all, my abiding memory was after the game. There he was, my boyhood hero, Jimmy Dial, standing looking down on the fields of legends and fields of dreams. Jimmy Dial was only 14 years old when he played his first All-Ireland minor hurling final. He won three more of them and went on, of course, to play in 9 senior All-Ireland finals, and he won 6 of them. He still looks as nimble as ever, skillful in the time where Hell's Kitchen, I think, was called the Tipperary full back line. But Jimmy was my man. We both looked down. The field was emptying very fast. I think of the title, The Field of Dreams, The Field of Legends, Jimmy Dial. It doesn't get any better.